Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, coming to you from San Francisco. Our program is supported by listeners, and I want to single out a few. David Lichtenstein of Davenport, Florida, and Marianne Crawford of Seattle, Washington. Supporters of the PBC show, you can help too. And if you're in a position to do that, I appreciate it. Just go to my website at peterbcollins.com, and there's information for you on how you can sign up for a monthly subscription for as little as $5 a month. What you're about to hear is the next installment in the Boiling Frogs podcast interview series, co-hosted with Sibel Edmonds. And our guest today is Melvin A. Goodman. He spent most of his professional career working for our government and was an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. His book is called Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And this podcast is distributed in collaboration with ConsortiumNews.com, where Mel Goodman posts his comments frequently. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling? Welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is Melvin A. Goodman. He served our nation at the Central Intelligence Agency, at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and also at the Department of Defense. He's the author or co-author of 6 books. I'll mention 2. Bush League Diplomacy, How the Neoconservatives Are Putting the World at Risk. That was published in 2004, co-authored with Craig Eisendrath. And his most recent book, which he wrote by himself, is Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Mel Goodman, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Peter B. Thank you, Sibel. Good to be with you both.
And I just want to confess and disclose that Mel Goodman and I have been talking on a regular basis since 2003 or 2004, and I have found him to be a very credible source of information on our intelligence community and our foreign policy. And he is a sharp critic of many of the excesses of the CIA, which he served with pride. And I recommend his book because in it he goes into great detail on the history of the agency and where it has crossed various lines. And a little bit later in our conversation, I want to skip to the last chapter to some of the recommendations you have made, Mel, and see how they square with the status of our intelligence community today. Let me begin with a recent piece that you published on the nonprofit journalism site called The Public Record, and that's pubrecord.org, because I think it'll offer us a pretty big frame for the conversation we're about to have. You took a look at a declassified study on the Cold War and Soviet intentions, and this is a period when you were active at the Central Intelligence Agency, and you conclude that there's a long history of exaggerating threats, in particular the Soviet threat, and you articulate your point of view, which is that current threats may be hyped or deeply exaggerated as well. Talk a little bit about going back to the Cold War, and in particular, our current Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was a high-ranking officer at the CIA and was currying political favor with the Reagan administration and their cowboy CIA director, Bill Casey.
Well, the real turning excuse me, the real turning point on all of this was 1981 when Reagan was inaugurated and he appointed William Casey to be a CIA director. Bill Casey was very involved in the campaign. Reagan felt he helped turn the campaign around after some initial primary disasters for the Reagan campaign, and he felt he owed Bill Casey something. Casey wanted to be the Secretary of State, but as Casey was told by one of Reagan's aides, you don't look like a Secretary of State, you don't think like a Secretary of State, you don't dress like a Secretary of State, and you don't talk like a Secretary of State. So we got him at the Central Intelligence Agency. Bill Casey was sort of a character out of Robert Ludlum. He was sort of a Jason Bourne wannabe. He had covert action plans for every country in the world. He had experience going back to World War II, where he served with OSS in Europe. And he was also an ideologue on issues involved with the Soviet Union, which is where Ronald Reagan wanted to go in terms of painting the Soviet Union as 10 feet tall and justifying a doubling of defense appropriations in the first 4 or 5 years of the Reagan administration. So it was Casey's job to give Reagan the intelligence to go to the Congress to justify the huge increases in the defense budget, much the same way that the CIA gave the Bush administration phony intelligence on Iraq so Bush could go to the Congress and get an approval for an authorization to use force in October of 2002.
And Mel, I vividly remember these dog and pony shows. They were pretty high-tech for the time, and Reagan, coming from Hollywood, kind of put his own mark on that. And these annual parades of the Soviet threat were fascinating, and I found them not credible at the time. I recall seeing and reading these national intelligence estimates and the pictures and films and other things that they brought to depict these threats, and I was unpersuaded. And, of course, as the Soviet Union began to implode, partly because of the great burden of the occupation of Afghanistan that they had undertaken at that time, it really laid bare for me that, we could not trust the intelligence community when there were political actors there who would take intelligence and use it clearly for political purposes.
Well, this was the delicious irony in all of this, because at the very point where the Soviet Union was in decline, was reducing its defense budget, was looking for a new relationship with the United States, did want to enter into arms control agreements, even on American terms, this is when Reagan was exaggerating the Soviet threat, using intelligence provided by Casey and Bob Gates, who was first the deputy director for intelligence and then the deputy director for the Central Intelligence Agency. So what you had in the 1980s is this tremendous increase in defense spending that we didn't need, that couldn't be justified as the threat was disappearing. And then you had the deficits of the early 90s that, of course, President Bill Clinton had to deal with in the first year of his administration. But the exaggeration was across the board in terms of dismissing Mikhail Gorbachev and Shevardnadze as something new in Soviet politics, in terms of exaggerating the strength of the Soviet economy, in terms of exaggerating the strength of the Warsaw Pact, which of course dissolved in 1990, a year before the Soviet Union itself came crashing down like a house of cards, because it was a house of cards, and of course exaggerating all sorts of indexes and characteristics of the Soviet political, economic, social, and military spheres. And, of course, Bob Gates was the filter for all of this. Casey was at the top of this structure, of essentially this conspiracy to exaggerate the Soviet threat, but it was Bob Gates as the deputy director for intelligence who knew where all the people were and knew how to get the publications out, including papers such as the Papal Plot, blaming the Soviet Union for the attempt to kill the Pope in 1981, exaggerating their defense spending, exaggerating their anti-ballistic missile system, ignoring their retreat from the Third World, which was essentially my first book in 1990, Gorbachev's retreat, dealing with the Third World. Gates basically sort of covered up all of this intelligence, wouldn't let it out of the building, and that's why in 1986 I left the CIA, and in 1991 I testified against Bob Gates when he was nominated by George Herbert Walker Bush to be the CIA director. This was a terrible period of politicization. the worst until the politicization to use intelligence to go to war, which, of course, is the greatest and most unconscionable threat and setback that I can think of for an intelligence agency. But Casey and Gates really set the pattern for what followed in this current period dealing with the war against Iraq.
And in your article, you talk about some of the neocons who were known as Team B, and they kind of set the stage for the way Dick Cheney had his own intelligence operation, some of which was being fed from Chalabi and this phony front group, the National Iraqi Congress. And talk a little bit about the way the neocons operated in the 80s and how many of the same people resurfaced in the Project for a New American Century and ultimately populating the appointed positions in the Bush administration.
Actually, I'm glad you raised that. It's worth going into that history a little bit. It started in 1975 when Gerald Ford was president. Dick Cheney was his chief of staff. Donald Rumsfeld was the youngest Secretary of Defense in our history at that particular time. Cheney and Rumsfeld were very close friends. Cheney and Rumsfeld were opposed to Henry Kissinger's role in the making of foreign policy and national security policy. They were opposed to his detente relationship with the Soviet Union. They were opposed to arms control. And they were opposed to the support that Central Intelligence Agency analysts were giving to the arms control process, because I think Kissinger could move forward in terms of arms control because, one, the CIA could monitor any arms control agreement. They had the technical savvy to do that. And two, CIA analysts essentially knew where the weaknesses were in the Soviet strategic system. So Cheney and Rumsfeld wanted to change all that, and they came up with the idea of a Team B approach, which would be essentially sending a group into the CIA, giving them total clearances to look at all of the intelligence, to read all of the sensitive reporting, and then essentially come up with their own national intelligence estimate of Soviet strategic power. Now, if this had been done fairly, you could argue, well, this is good. This is competitive analysis. But it wasn't done fairly. What Cheney and Rumsfeld did was to pick a neocon from Harvard, a professor by the name of Richard Pipes. He assembled a team of military analysts and civilian analysts, people like Paul Wolfowitz, you know, talk about names that kept recurring throughout American history in the last 30 or 40 years. General Danny Graham, William Van Cleve, people who were well known to the neoconservative community. So when this idea was broached to the CIA director, who at that time was William Colby, Colby said, no, I'm not letting this group in the building. This is not a fair way to look at intelligence. This is not the way to do competitive analysis. And Colby was soon dispatched and replaced by George Herbert Walker Bush, who didn't see any problem with bringing this team in. The irony is, at the very time that the Team B team was coming into the CIA, was the very time when the Soviets became aware of their own economic problems. And Brezhnev gave a very important speech in 1977, which recognized all of the economic problems and the need to cut back on military spending, the need to get arms control. And he lectured to his own military high command about the need to share their resources, their expertise, their personnel with the civilian side of the economy. So it's kind of ironic that here is Richard Pipes, the great Soviet scholar from Harvard, wrong about all of the strategic issues of the day. And then when you jump to the 1980s, you get Bob Gates, who's basically the senior Kremlinologist within the Central Intelligence Agency, wrong about all the Central Intelligence questions of the day in terms of who was Mikhail Gorbachev when he emerged in 1985, what would he stand for, was he the genuine article, could he really institute a change. And then when you jump ahead to the 1990s, you see the neocons having an important impact throughout the political debates in this country over the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and Iraq and Iran specifically. And those neocons, again, people like Paul Wolfowitz, people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Van Cleve and others, who are the ones making the case and pushing the case for war, which Cheney finally got against Iraq in 2003. So this goes back to the mid-1970s. This is 35 years now of neocon policy that has put this country in a terrible national security position, which a very inexperienced president now, Barack Obama, with what I think is a very weak national security team, unfortunately it includes Robert Gates at the the Pentagon, a very inexperienced Hillary Clinton, a very ordinary, very pedestrian Marine Corps general, a retired general, James Jones, and a very weak intelligence community led by Admiral Dennis Blair as the Director of National Intelligence, and a very disappointing Leon Panetta as the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And we are probably facing the worst series of political and military situations when you look at our relationship vis-a-vis Iran, North Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East generally, the whole Palestinian-Israeli equation. There is far too much on Obama's plate, and he has complicated the problem by appointing so-called czars, which I think just diffuses the policy process, a czar for the Middle East in terms of George Mitchell, a czar for Afghanistan and Pakistan in terms of Richard Holbrooke, and a czar for Iran in terms of Dennis Ross. And there's no coherence right now to foreign policy. I think Obama has extremely good intentions and has very good instincts, and in his inaugural speech in January of this year, he made it clear he wanted to reverse direction and to stop the descent of the United States and the credibility of the United States in the global arena. But when you look at all of these problems, frankly, they've all worsened in the last 6 or 7 years, and when you look down Afghanistan, now we're really wandering again into a very difficult situation where we can't win, and I don't even think we can succeed.
Mel, and how does the Congress back then, if you were to compare it to Congress today, and I'm talking about during the 70s and 80s and early 90s, with Congress today, and let's say today in the last 6, 7 years, how do you make that comparison between back then and now?
Well, I think there are two important comparisons that are worth talking about. One is in the 1970s, you still had a functioning Congress and a functional Congress. In the mid-1970s, for example, you had the Church Commission hearings on the CIA in the Senate, and you had the Pike Commission hearings on the CIA in the House of Representatives, which came up with actual reforms establishing the congressional oversight process for the intelligence community. So if you jump ahead to the current situation, you have a totally dysfunctional Congress, which can't agree on, well, we're seeing it played out on the domestic arena in terms of health care reform, which is getting worse every day and has plummeted to a new low with a plan that Senator Max Baucus has unveiled from his position as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and they play no real role in foreign policy. And when you look at their vote in 2002, authorization to use force, they never challenged the weak intelligence and the phony and fabricated intelligence they were getting from the CIA. So on the functional level, you had a functional Congress in the 1970s. You have a dysfunctional Congress in the current period. Then on another level, you really have the kind of acrimony and controversy and dispute going on between the two parties, between the Democrats and the Republicans, that have in part contributed to this dysfunctional nature. The Congress is essentially the broken branch of government. It doesn't work. And we see this played out over and over again. But when you look at the anger within the two-party system, people forget that in the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson, who was in many ways our greatest domestic president since Franklin Roosevelt, when he got through Medicare, which was considered a major achievement for Lyndon Johnson, half the Republicans in the Senate and half the Republicans in the House voted for Medicare. Now you fast forward to the current situation. You have no Republicans in the House of Representatives. In fact, they're trying to use health care reform to undermine Obama's presidency, ignoring what the needs of the American people are. And with the exception of Olympia Snow from Maine, you really have no Republicans in the Senate who are willing to support genuine health care reform and are being serious in this debate with regard to health care reform. And what I'm afraid of now is that now the Afghan debate is going to enter into the halls of the Senate and to a lesser degree in the House. You have no real foreign policy leadership, even though I think John Kerry can be very effective in this way as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Carl Levin from Michigan as chairman of the Armed Forces Committee. But there's going to be a real debate over additional troops for Afghanistan. I think we're just going to blunder further into this Afghan situation by sending more and more troops. So the functional versus the dysfunctional, and then the great animosity and the inability to work across bipartisan lines on issues that are really important to the American people, war and peace in the case of Afghanistan, and health care in terms of the current domestic situation, that this is appalling for the American people, and we're all going to suffer as a result of this broken branch of government.
Oh, it's interesting because I remember that's exactly what Cy Hirsch, Zimmer Hirsch, said. I was with him during one of these gatherings. One of the audience, one of the people asked the question, well, you never ever address the issue of Congress or Congress's position. And Cy just turned around and said, well, Congress has been irrelevant. They
Congress
have
has made
broken itself branch, and they've
irrelevant.
Been irrelevant.
They're absent without leave. They're AWOL. I think that's true.
Well, and Mel, one of the things that has surfaced in our previous interviews in this series, the Boiling Frog series, is the sense that the members of Congress who have oversight responsibility don't really want to know. And they create deniability chains, and they essentially duck their oversight responsibilities so that they can later just claim ignorance. And this seems to be something that's getting worse, not better.
Well, I think the best example of this, and I totally agree with what you say, the best example is the intelligence oversight process, which is a case of genuine oversight. What we're getting is oversight. We're not getting any real overseeing of the intelligence community. They're not paying any attention. And, of course, this was best demonstrated when Nancy Pelosi several months ago claimed she was lied to by the CIA and not told about the various programs involving torture and abuse and secret prisons and renditions. Well, she wasn't lied to. She was given information. It was incomplete information and very partial information. And to an extent, she was bamboozled, and I've written about that. But the important thing is the few people who got these briefings, the group of four or the group of eight, never issued any protests about the briefings that included demonstrations of things such as waterboarding. So you have to ask, where in the world were these leaders, including Nancy Pelosi, Jay Rockefeller, who at that time was head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, earlier Peter Hoekstra, who was the leading Republican member of the House Oversight Committee.
Jane Harman of California.
Jane Harman was another one who was, again, I think, absent without leave. And today we're seeing it played out as with Dianne Feinstein and Congressman Reyes from Texas, who are ignoring the fact that the statutory inspector general of the CIA announced his retirement in February of this year, 7 months or so ago. And so the CIA is now without a statutory IG. Now, the IG, the Office of the Inspector General, is the only office that has produced a comprehensive account of the detentions and interrogations policies of the CIA and the actions of the CIA. This was produced in 2004. There was no follow-up, and there was no follow-up because you had three CIA directors, first Porter Goss, then Michael Hayden, and now this great disappointment, Leon Panetta, who have not allowed the Inspector General's office to function, and now they don't even have a statutory Inspector General, which was one of the reforms that was created after the Iran-Contra crisis of the 1980s. So again, you have people like Feinstein and Reyes who are not paying attention to any of these serious problems of the Central Intelligence Agency that include now an assassination program that Panetta finally did bring to the attention of the House and the Senate after you had this cover-up claiming that Dick Cheney had ordered them not to brief any of these materials. And it's interesting that you had the former executive director of the CIA under George Tenet, a man by the name of Buzzy Krongard, who left the CIA after awarding Blackwater secretly this contract to set up the assassination program. He then took a position on the board of advisors of Blackwater and then began to administrate the secret assassination program. And this is interesting because, remember, since you mentioned Seymour Hersh, it was Cy Hirsch who exposed the possibility, and everyone laughed at him at the time, that the military had developed an assassination program under the leadership of Dick Cheney, and he was obviously on to something. And we still don't know, was there a separate military program? My guess is that Hirsch did have sources within the White House and learned something about this assassination program that turned out to be a secret assassination program by the CIA that the Congress was never told about, which is a violation of the charter of the CIA and legislation that was established to make sure that covert actions were briefed to the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees, and that the president had to draw up a finding for a secret covert action. And nothing could be more sensitive than an assassination program, because this is how the CIA got into so much trouble in the 1960s and 70s. And again, we have Seymour Hersh to thank for this, his expose that won a Pulitzer Prize in the 1970s about the assassination programs that led to the Church investigation, the Church Committee investigation, the Pike Commission investigation, and the Rockefeller Commission. And here was the CIA stupidly going back into the same assassination business and hiring, of all people, a group of basically mercenaries and criminals who populate the world of the Blackwater Company. We know about what they've done in Iraq up to this time, and now we're hearing more about other contractors and their crimes in Afghanistan, who are supposedly providing security for high-level members of the embassies and the military in Afghanistan and Iraq. So this is just a terrible picture. And it's all part of this terrible mess that Barack Obama has inherited as president, and he's carefully trying to climb his way out of this terrible and unconscionable situation.
Now, Mel, one of the other significant shifts, if we compare the 60s and 70s to the present day, is that the media has not been playing a significant role in, as the so-called Fourth Estate, in monitoring the actions of our government, in investigating critical issues such as the torture policy, such as the domestic eavesdropping policies that remain active. And you recently have kind of taken on a new assignment as a self-styled media critic, and you've had your sights set on your local newspaper, the Washington Post, which is the Beltway's newspaper of record. It sets the agenda for coverage by other news outlets, in particular the television networks. And you found quite a bit to criticize there. So take a couple of minutes here and explain to our listeners what's wrong with the Washington Post and how different its role today is from its high watermark at the Watergate era and the Nixon presidency.
Well, it's interesting to make the comparison if you go back to the Watergate era. The Watergate era, and here the Washington Post, we've either read or seen All the President's Men. We know what Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward did in the 1960s. We know about the role of Ben Bradley as the editor of the paper at that time, and the risks they took on, and the warnings they got in terms of not publishing certain accounts. And they've got Katharine Graham, the editor of the paper at that time, the publisher of the paper, to stiffen her spine and to go ahead with stories that essentially brought down the Nixon administration for all of the law breaking that was taking place in the 1970s. Now you have to look at the Washington Post. You have Katharine Graham's granddaughter. Her name is Weymouth. I can't think of her first name right now. A very weak publisher of the paper. You have a neoconservative editor by the name of Fred Hyatt. And you have a stable of op-ed and editorial writers led by David Ignatius and David Broder. Michael Gerson, who was hired after he left the Bush administration as the chief speechwriter for President George W. Bush, Kathleen Parker, Richard Cohn, all these people who've become, Charles Krauthammer would be another one, they've become apologists for CIA. And they've been leading a campaign against the Attorney General, Eric Holder, who has very bravely issued the torture memos that were produced in the Bush administration by such lawyers as J. Bybee and John Yoo, who both live out your way in California.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
They're yours. They're yours. You can deal with these people. But they've been protesting Eric Holder's efforts to set up a special investigator to see whether there should be prosecution. And the simple matter, the simple fact in this matter is laws were broken. How can you ignore the fact that torture and abuse was conducted, that even if you look at the memos as being the law of the day, the torturing that went on by CIA individuals and contractors with the CIA went way beyond what the torture memos prescribed. And you also have to go back to the Nuremberg precedent from World War II, the important trials that took place in Germany in 1945 and 1946, in which if you obey a law and conduct yourself illegally in the process, the fact that you are operating under a state law does not absolve you of any guilt or responsibility. And any crimes you commit in the name of defending the state that are indeed crimes will have to be punished, will have to be resolved in a judiciary setting. And, of course, the Washington Post is fighting all this. They're defending the CIA, and they're coming up with this canard that was given to them basically by high-ranking CIA officers who don't want to see their transgressions exposed in American media, let alone in American courts, is that this will really harm the morale of the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, I happen to know the former Inspector General very well from the CIA, John Helgerson.
Mm-hmm.
And John Helgerson has said, and he gave an interview to Der Spiegel, it's interesting that John Helgerson is now willing to talk to the press, but he hasn't been interviewed by any major American outlet that I'm aware of. And he said people used to come up to him in the cafeteria of the CIA and give him credit for the 2004 study that exposed the torture policies and the renditions policies and the detentions policies of the CIA, and hope that there would be more accountability and transparency to get to the bottom of all this, so the CIA, which is essentially a law-abiding group in terms of the great overwhelming majority of the people at the CIA, they want to see this exposed. So it's morale that would be enhanced by these investigations, and certainly not harmed.
Now, Mel, let me first of all reference that people can read your commentaries about the Washington Post at two websites, consortiumnews.com, that's Robert Perry's journalism site based in Washington, and also at the Public Record, which is pubrecord.org, and they're based in Los Angeles. And let me just read a couple of quotes here from the piece that you wrote called Time for the CIA's Chief Apologist to Apologize. This was published toward the end of August. Quote, for the past two decades, the Washington Post's David Ignatius has been the mainstream media's most active apologist for the transgressions of the CIA. Ignatius reached a new low last month when he used two op-ed columns to trivialize the CIA's use of torture and abuse against detainees and to dismiss the need for an investigation of the CIA's illegal assassination program against suspected terrorists. And you lifted a quote, nobody had been killed. In both cases, Ignatius relied on high-level sources from the CIA's National Clandestine Service to make the best possible case for the agency. This is neither good reporting nor professional journalism. Now, Mel, do your former colleagues at the CIA see you as a guy who is holding a standard that they wish to aspire to and wish to adhere to? Or do they see you as a guy who is embarrassing them by taking on one of their lead defenders?
Well, I have to admit that it's probably more of the latter. I think most of them wish that I would just go away and shut up. Their feeling was, and I've gotten this from a lot of people who I thought were my friends, from 1991 when I testified against Bob Gates, they thought that was a good thing. And I was getting a lot of phone calls at home, and I was getting a lot of support, and there were people writing affidavits that they were submitting to the Senate that Senator Warren Rudman tried to shut down when he referred to all these people as McCarthyites for going after Robert Gates, which was an obnoxious charge. But then the feeling was, once I had done that, I had done my thing, and now I should shut up and just go about my business and find another line of work rather than to become a critic of the CIA. So there is a very great defensiveness at the CIA now. There is a great circling of the wagons. They are a beleaguered and besieged organization, but they're beleaguered and besieged because you had the politicization of intelligence on the Soviet Union, the strategic intelligence failure of 9/11, which they would never admit to being a strategic intelligence failure, even though now we have an Inspector General report that came out in 2004 that not only documented the errors and the mistakes that were made at the CIA, but they even called for an accountability board that would put former director George Tenet before the accountability board for all of his failures leading up to 9/11. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the worst crime of all, providing false intelligence to enable George Bush and Dick Cheney to take this country to a war that was totally unnecessary and totally unneeded and has caused nothing but great strife for the United States throughout the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and Southwest Asia. So I'm not getting a great deal of support. There's still a few people I talk to who are quietly supportive, but it's not like anyone wants to invite me to become their friend on Facebook. I'm not getting a lot of that.
I have a question, Mel. You mentioned during your conversation about the Washington Post, specifically about the last two decades, but it seems to be the case for more than that, because in 1977, Carl Bernstein wrote this piece for Rolling Stone and was talking about documents that obtained that show these reporters on the payroll of CIA. And one of the guys there was Walter Pincus.
And well, I know Walter Pincus very well, and I just can't believe I've disagreed with Walter Pincus over the years, and I think Walter Pincus has become kind of lazy-minded in his coverage of the CIA. But to say that he's on the payroll of the CIA, I think, goes much too far.
I will send you the link to this article published in Rolling Stone, because they did get these documents that said all these newspapers who were cooperating overseas by willingly providing information. In some cases, some of them were getting paid. But with Walter Pincus, another recent revelation had to do with his son. With this Blackwater case that we just mentioned, we just talked about, Walter Pincus' son is representing Blackwater in court right now in Alexandria. He's the attorney for Blackwater. And guess who is covering the Blackwater story for Washington Post? That happens to be Walter Pincus.
Well, he's not really the exclusive reporter on that. Walter Pincus jumps around to all sorts of issues. I think what's more important, though, is if you compare the daily reporting of the New York Times to the daily reporting of the Washington Post on national security issues, the Times is beating the Post like a drum. So when you look at the fine reporting that's done by Scott Shain and Mark Mazzetti, and a few others at the New York Times, and then compare that to the pathetic coverage that you're getting from the Washington Post. And I consider Walter Pincus now to become extremely lazy in his reporting of things dealing with the CIA. I do accuse him of that. That they're just not getting the stories in terms of the detention interrogation story, this the extraordinary renditions story, all of the torture and abuse issues. We're seeing pretty good coverage in the New York Times and excellent editorial writing, whereas the Post has lagged behind the Times on all of these issues for the last 3 or 4 years, and you've got an editorial position that's very supportive of the CIA and very supportive of Leon Panetta, and you have people like David Ignatius relying on the deputy director of the CIA, Stephen Kappas, who was the ideological driver for all of these policies and, of course, doesn't want to see any transparency or accountability, because he's the one who will ultimately be accountable. But this, you know, begs serious questions about the CIA director, Leon Panetta, and President Obama's appointment of Panetta after he couldn't get his first choice, John Brennan, who never should have been in a position to even be considered to be the CIA director. And it was the efforts of several of us. We were called these liberal bloggers who were sitting around in front of our computers in our basements, sitting in our underwear, eating Cheetos and coming up with ways we could defeat the John Brennan nomination. Well, John Brennan was not qualified to be the CIA director, but Obama has insisted, and now he's basically the deputy director of the National Security Council at the White House, and because of the very mediocre job that General James Jones is doing, it's very likely that within a year or so, you're going to see John Brennan as the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States. And John Brennan, for those who don't know who John Brennan was the chief cheerleader for all of these policies of torture and abuse and renditions and detentions going on television shows, syndicated shows, talking to reporters and making the case for all of these policies as the executive director to the CIA director, George Tenet. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And this is really what's regrettable when you look at Obama's national security team of Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates and John Brennan and Leon Panetta and Dennis Blair and James Jones. This is a very disappointing group at a time when the United States faces such severe national security challenges because of the abysmal record of the George Bush and Dick Cheney team. So the country is at a very difficult juncture right now.
Well, these are great points. I completely agree with you. Now, how does that play with Obama actually inheriting this stuff? Because it seems to be the case that these happen to be her his choice. And that comes to whether it was on civil liberties-related issues with NSA's illegal wiretapping. Yeah, is it the case that he inherited, or is it the case that this is something that he, as a president, is actually pushing for? Because with the state secrets privilege, the Obama administration went even further than the Bush administration, saying that not only that this NSA-related court case is covered by the state secrets with the state secrets privilege, but also we have a sovereign immunity as government. And yesterday there was this headline news in one of the alternative publications on how right now Obama administration is pushing for the extension of three really awful provisions of Patriot Act that is set to expire in the next few months.
Including the national security letters for libraries.
Correct. And this, my point is here, actually my question is, these are not things that have been inherited. These are the things that are done willfully by choice. And I know there are a lot of apologists out there and talking about President Obama inheriting this. He has been there only for 5 or 6 months. But then we take these actions one by one, these decisions one by one. This goes totally beyond inheriting problems from the previous administration. And how does that play with inheriting this mess from the previous administration?
Well, I'm of two minds here, I must say. On the one hand, I'm grateful for the fact that Barack Obama is president of the United States. I supported him. I was a surrogate speaker on his behalf during the campaign. I can't think of anyone I would rather have in the White House right now other than Barack Obama when you look at the various choices that we had. And when I went down, as Peter B. knows, when I went down to the inaugural speech because I did an interview with Peter B. coming back on my bicycle from
the
mall that day when I was half frozen. I don't even know if I could speak coherently. I was very excited about the speech because he talked about restoring the rule of law. I was very grateful for what he did in announcing the closing of Guantanamo. I was grateful for what he did in terms of bringing an end to torture and abuse. I was grateful for the release of the Justice Department torture memos. I was grateful for the fact that even though he's saying he's going to continue the policy of renditions when necessary, there have been no renditions since President Obama became the president. And let's face it, renditions are nothing more than the kidnapping of people, often innocent, so we don't have to worry about missing detainees and ghost detainees in CIA secret prisons, which were also closed down. I was grateful for the fact that he's trying to reorient American foreign policy and move more quickly in terms of getting American troops out of Iraq. But as you say, he has used the state secret provision in areas where I don't think he should have been. We've been putting pressure on the Brits not to release information about the renditions program and the overflights of Europe, which were very quite numerous in terms of bringing these rendered people back and forth to various secret prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere in the world, including Eastern Europe. Why in the world we thought we could create secret prisons in Europe and not have this thing leak, which, of course, that it did, to the great embarrassment of the European countries who were involved, as well as the United States. But it is a mixed picture. He hasn't done everything that I thought he would do, and he's had some, to me, low-hanging fruit where he could have moved very quickly. I'm not happy with the fact that he restored travel for Cuban Americans to go back to Cuba, but he won't lift the sanctions on Cuba. He hasn't moved quickly enough. I think it's ridiculous to be pursuing this policy of training the Georgian army and sending military supplies and American military trainers to Georgia, only to irritate the Russians when we need to establish a good dialogue with Russia, because there's so many things the United States and Russia agree about in terms of international security where we need to be working together. I'm appalled that he hasn't stopped this program of introducing an anti-ballistic missile system into Poland and the Czech Republic, which not only irritates the Russians, but irritates Iran. You know, the idea of an ABM system in Central Europe to guard against an Iranian missile attack against Europe is pure science fiction. You know, I can't think of a scenario where Europe would be targeting Europe.
Right,
Iran
and now you're a member of
national.
You're a member of National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. We got actually a signed statement from Senator Obama at that time on National Security Whistleblowers inclusion in Whistleblower Protection Act, and he said when he was the candidate, he said absolutely, and he actually signed it. We have his signed promise. And he went back on that. Currently, President Obama, the White House, is opposing the inclusion of national security whistleblowers. That means whistleblowers from the CIA and the FBI and the Department of Defense. You know, you were included during our campaigns during the Bush administration. So that's another major promise that he went back on. And as I said, the secrecy, and that includes the state secrets privilege. And, of course, you mentioned what's the situation in Afghanistan. And also the situation with the new prison in Bagram and how we are treating the prisoners there. So, but as you said, with the choices that we had out there, he appeared to be the best choice. But then again, the question comes to who really gives us those choices to start with?
Well, it's clear that we're not going to get everything we want. If you look at the agenda, which would be essentially a progressive agenda for reorienting American national security policy and really demilitarizing American national security policy, which I think needs to be done. There have been measures that I've been pleased with and measures that I haven't been pleased with. I certainly wasn't happy when I found out that Robert Gates was going to continue as Secretary of Defense, given my efforts to defeat Bob Gates as the CIA director in 1991.
Right.
And even now, even though I think Bob Gates has changed in many ways, and I'm not saying he's the same person in 2009 that he was in 1991, but essentially Bob Gates is a windsock. He's not going to take an independent position on even an issue, and he's already waffled now on do we need more troops in Afghanistan or not. He's gone back and forth. He will wait to get his instructions, and then he will move ahead. We need a more powerful person who is well-versed in military issues, which Bob Gates isn't, to be running the Pentagon at this particular time, because if there's real savings to be had in the American budget right now for things like health care, it would be in this inflated defense bill that we see every year that now has reached a level of about $700 billion, which doesn't include all of the spending on intelligence, which is about $55 billion a year, plus the money we are wasting in Iraq and Afghanistan for two wars, essentially, that we're really losing. So clearly more needs to be done, and I think Obama's feet have to be held to the fire on all of this, but I'm certainly a lot happier that he's sitting in the White House rather than John McCain, or if he had lost in the campaign to Hillary Clinton. But the important thing is to keep up the kind of shows that you and Peter B. are promoting, and keep up the kind of editorial writing that needs to be done in order to hold their feet to the fire. This is essential.
Mel, I want to jump on something you said a little earlier in your critique of the Washington Post, and you stated your view that you think the New York Times is doing a better job, and I generally agree with you. But we have serious problems, and I want to illustrate it with this example. Mark Klein is a San Francisco, he's a retired AT&T technician, and he's the one who exposed the wiretap room on Folsom Street at the AT&T facility, where they were diverting every bit of incoming traffic, telephone, internet, what have you, through a splitter to the National Security Agency. And Klein has published a book about it, which is fascinating on a number of levels, but what really gripped me was his descriptions of how he got screwed by the mainstream media. And I'll give you two examples. One is that he went to the Los Angeles Times and he gave them his story. And instead of publishing his story, the LA Times took that information to John Negroponte, who was the National Intelligence Director at the time. And as a result, the Times, you know, ended up essentially complicit with the non-disclosure of this illegal domestic wiretapping program. And then when the New York Times, a year after they really had completed their investigation, and a year after the 2004 elections, it was in early December of 2005, that James Risen and Eric Lichtblau published the information that disclosed to most of us for the first time that there was an illegal domestic wiretapping program. They used the euphemism that it was warrantless, but I call it illegal. Well, Mark Klein, after the Times published those articles, contacted Lichtblau and Risen. They were interested. They took information from him, and they never used it. They never published it. And likewise, he sat for an interview with 60 Minutes, which demanded an exclusive. They held on to that exclusive for months, which prevented Mark Klein from going to other media outlets when the story was its hottest. And ultimately, 60 Minutes never ran the Mark Klein interview. So at least on that subject, we see various critical elements of the corporate media not just failing to do their job, but actively colluding with the government agencies that need to be investigated and need a little sunshine.
Well, there's no question that the New York Times was covering up a story that James Risen had. You're more familiar with the Mark Klein aspect than I am. I'm familiar with the James Risen aspect because they sat on this story and they sat on it until the book was about to come out, and they knew they were going to be scooped by one of their own reporters. In James Risen's remarkable book, which was a very important work at the time, and Bill Keller, the editor of the paper, has admitted that he was wrong to sit on this story for 13 months, and we've never gotten a full explanation of why these decisions were made. So, but these are sort of the problems we have with the mainstream media. I'm not saying that the New York Times is the perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not the paper of record that it used to be, that it still claims to be. It is the best newspaper we have in the country. I find it more thorough and more reliable, and with reporters I've mentioned before, such as Scott Shane and Mark Mazzetti, I think they're doing the best job on national security issues. But there have been these terrible incidents, and again, that's why the mainstream media and their feet have to be held to the fire. The court system, I think, has tilted in the direction of deferring on all national security problems. The Congress is not doing its job. Now, when you think of the system that the Founding Fathers set up in terms of giving free press to the media, which I think was the First Amendment for very important reasons, because they thought this criticism was important to keep the government honest, and the Congress is mentioned in the Constitution before the powers of the presidency, and of course we know the importance of the courts. Well, if the courts are going to defer on national security, and the press is going to collude and cover up important issues of national security, and the Congress isn't even going to investigate transgressions in the field of national security, what in the hell are the people supposed to do in terms of protecting the rights of the citizens and being well-informed on these issues that involve very unconscionable actions by first the Bush administration and then some dubious actions on the part of the Obama administration. We have to be vigilant in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what we were told by the Founding Fathers, certainly by Benjamin Franklin and James Madison, and all of the major contributors to the Federalist Papers, who warned about not allowing the United States to repeat the mistakes that were made in Europe that led to one tyranny after another. And I'm afraid there's been such a dumbing down in this country, with the press getting weaker and weaker in terms of their coverage of these issues, and the Congress not playing a role, that in some ways the American people are being routed by very powerful government. And we see this not only internationally, we see it domestically when you look at the plan Max Baucus put forward and the millions of dollars that Max Baucus gets in his campaign coffers from the health insurance companies. So we're at a very difficult juncture. There's no question of that.
Well, and we also see that in a time where there have been massive cutbacks and layoffs in news gathering for both print and broadcast, they still will throw, you know, pull out all the stops and throw lots of resources at, how Michael Jackson died, or this salacious story of the couple that kidnapped a child 18 years ago here in California. They'll go into great depth on those stories, but not the ones that really are most critical to the future of our alleged democracy here.
Well, part of the problem I have with that is, you know, the Michael Jackson story and the kidnapping stories, those are easy for the press. Those stories are basically given to the press.
Mm-hmm.
The really hard stories deal with arms control issues, the warrantless eavesdropping of the NSA, and the fact that the director of NSA at the time, Michael Hayden, then went on to become the director of the CIA and was not even asked about this in any serious way during his confirmation hearings. Why wasn't that pursued? That the very lawyer who counseled Michael Hayden on how the Constitution be ignored by this illegal wiretapping, as you say, then was brought to the CIA by Michael Hayden and leads the fight against the Office of the Inspector General to make sure no more critical reports appear within the building that are then passed to the Congress. So there's so much going on that we do not know about, or we don't make an effort to educate ourselves about, and the press doesn't really have the energy or the rigor or the honesty, the integrity to pursue these stories. And that's why I went after David Ignatius, because I know who his sources are. I know there's Stephen Kappes, the deputy director of CIA, and I know there's Mike Sulick, who is the head of the National Clandestine Service. They talked to Ignatius on a regular basis, but they had one person who apparently talked to a journalist several years ago who was run out of the building by Puttergast for having unauthorized discussions with the press. Well, what about these conversations? Are these authorized conversations when CIA officials talk to David Ignatius or to David Broder or to Walter Pincus, and they report without any challenge or any attempt to get other sources?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they talk to the critics? Do they talk to contrarians? You know, that's what you have a press for. And I think at one point I cited Justice Hugo Black, in which he talked about the fact that the most important responsibility of the free press is the duty to prevent any part of the government from deceiving the people and sending them off to distant lands to die in foreign wars. Well, that's exactly what they did or didn't do in 2002 and 2003, when a handful of us were calling the press on a regular basis saying, you cannot believe CIA intelligence, you cannot believe these fabricated reports that deal with Saddam Hussein trying to get enriched uranium from Niger, you can't believe the reports of this so-called source with the name Curveball, who was being held by the Germans, who was talking about mobile biological labs. He's crazy. He's an alcoholic. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But except for a couple reporters, particularly Warren Strobel, who I think was with the Philadelphia Inquirer at the time, they blew us off. Reporters from the Washington Post blew me off. Reporters from the New York Times would talk, but this stuff never appeared in their papers. You had someone like Judith Miller, who was probably, you know, talk about someone who's on the payroll. She was doing the bidding of the Pentagon. And frankly, Michael Gordon, who I think is a good military reporter, he wasn't skeptical enough of the crap that he was being spoon-fed by the Pentagon and by the Bush administration. And there should be real embarrassment at the media to make sure this never happens again. But here you have it happening again at the Washington Post, of all places.
Well, I had trouble with Gordon, too. I interviewed him once. He co-authored a book, and I don't remember the general who was his co-author, but he was cashing in on the Iraq War.
That was Bernie Traynor.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we had Thomas Ricks, though, the military correspondent from the Washington Post, who has written two very good books. He has since left the paper, and I think has his own blog out there. And I think that's why the move has gone toward progressive radio and these blog sites, these people sitting around in their underwear in the basement, according to the New Yorker magazine, eating Cheetos.
For the record, I have no Cheetos, and I'm fully dressed.
Okay.
My shoes are not on, though, if anybody cares about that.
That's the nice thing about radio.
Mel, I want to turn to the final chapter of your book, Failure of Intelligence, where you ask the question, what needs to be done? And in order to frame that, let me offer you some quotes from the new intelligence czar, Dennis Blair. He gave a speech in San Francisco a couple of days ago, and the Chronicle quoted a few things. Quote, if we had this system of working back on 9/11, that's working the different agencies coordinated, I don't think the attacks would have occurred. We now know enough about these terrorist organizations that wish to harm us that we are stopping them with far less information than was available on 9/11. Another quote, this strategy advances our original founding directive to achieve an intelligence community that is integrated and collaborative. But it goes much further than that. It reflects a more refined understanding of the threats we face and how we will combat them. Do you find these comments credible? We know that the NSA and the FBI and the CIA were not well coordinated in the months leading up to 9/11, and I have nothing really to suggest that that has dramatically changed.
There's no reason to think that it's changed. And frankly, when he talks about integrated and collaborative, and he's a military man, remember he's a retired naval admiral, he's talking about a centralized system, which is the worst way to produce good, aggressive intelligence to pass to policymakers. The problem with his office that was created by the Intelligence Reform Act that followed the 9/11 Commission and the recommendation for an intelligence czar is it's become totally centralized, totally militarized. The Pentagon controls the intelligence community. They control about 85% of the budget of the intelligence community, 90% of the personnel of the intelligence community. And I think in that same speech, Blair talked about the fact there's no difference between national intelligence and military intelligence. Well, if he can say that, it shows he has no understanding of the role of strategic intelligence and that the need to have something more than just tactical or operational intelligence so that policymakers and decision makers, and particularly the President of the United States, can understand the various complexities out there in the international arena that have an impact on the status of the United States and the global community. And Blair is just the wrong person to be in that job. But remember, his predecessor was also a military man, another retired naval admiral who was a former student of mine at the National War College, who was in way over his head. John Negroponte was in the job for only about a year before he decided to get out and go to the State Department. He wasn't qualified because, remember, he covered up the crimes in Central America in the 1980s and lied before congressional committees. So this whole business of an intelligence czar, in fact, the whole business of the czars, and I hold Obama responsible for this, we have czars for every aspect of American domestic and international policy. We have a czar for the Middle East. We have a czar for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We have a czar for Iran, someone who's never really studied Iran, Dennis Ross. We have all sorts of domestic czars. We have a health czar. We have an environment czar. We have a climate czar.
Don't forget the drug czar.
And the ever-popular drug czar. He's certainly done a lot of good, hasn't he? I think I could even get drugs now if I made a real effort. So the political process and the policy process has really broken down. And you've got very weak figures who are running these very important components of government. And so you take Obama, who I think is extremely bright, with good intuition and good sense. I think he demonstrated that on the recent mini-crisis with regard to Iran. He still is not experienced in these areas, and we're seeing mistakes being made. You know, Sabell pointed out some. You've pointed out some. I've pointed out others. I still think the entire picture is mixed, and each person is going to have to do his own net assessment based on the pluses and minuses, but I think we're better off with Obama than we certainly were with Bush, and certainly would have been with John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly not going to be good enough in the end if we end up fighting another war in Afghanistan, which Alexander the Great couldn't win and Queen Victoria couldn't win and Leo Brezhnev and several other Soviet leaders couldn't win.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think we're going to do nation building in this tribalized society out of the 15th century, then I don't know what they're speaking of drugs. I don't know what they're smoking in the White House these days.
So, Mel, your final chapter of Failure Intelligence is called What Needs to Be Done. If you had, say, three or four issues that are paramount today that still remain unaddressed. What would those be?
Well, these three I want to point out in the context of a study that you may or may not be aware of that the Brookings Institute just released on the intelligence community and the need for reform. It is a terrible study. It is a feckless study. And they don't mention any of the things I'm about to cite. One, you need to demilitarize the intelligence community. You have to take the Pentagon's hands off the intelligence community. You're not going to get fair-minded, objective, balanced, hard-hitting, incisive intelligence while you have a policy agency that has an axe to grind, which the Pentagon does, with its total control of the intelligence community. Two, you have to deprivatize the intelligence community. Now there's a huge part of the budget, some say as high as 60% of the budget, that goes to private contractors and independent contractors. If you look at all the crimes that have been committed by the CIA and the intelligence community in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo, then you see the role of private contractors, you know, the work of Buzzy Krongard and the Blackwater group and the
Kofor
group.
Kofor Black, who jumped
Black,
from the agency
the CIA,
to Blackwater.
Went right to a high-ranking position at Blackwater, which shouldn't even be allowed, because then he's spending money that he contracted for when he was involved as head of the counterterrorism center of the CIA. You need to decentralize the CIA. You have to abolish this role of intelligence czar. The idea that you could have one person who would be this great fountain of wisdom on all sorts of difficult intelligence matters, and now it's in the hands of a retired admiral, is just ludicrous. You need competitive analysis. You need redundancy. You need duplicity. You need more than one source. You need all sorts of competitive ways to get finally to truth, which is so elusive in the intelligence field because you're never going to get all the data you really need to form a final opinion that you can have great confidence in. The best you can do is have different analysts and different agencies and different departments compete for who provides the best intelligence to one administration or another. So these are the things that have to be done. And finally, you have to have people who are willing to tell truth to power, not like George Tenet, who said it would be a slam dunk to provide Bush with the intelligence he needed, not like his deputy, John McLaughlin, who actually gave the slam dunk briefing to President Bush's administration a couple months before the war, and not people like John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who wrote those unconscionable torture memos that read something out of fascist governments that we're all too familiar with, whether it be Germany or Italy or Japan in the 1930s or the Soviet Union throughout the period of the Cold War. So, and this is how you reverse the deterioration that we've seen in the intelligence community.
Yeah. Mel Goodman, thank you for joining us today. Is there anything you'd like to add in closing?
No, I want to thank you for the opportunity to spend a whole hour on these important issues. That's very unusual in radio, television, or newspapers these days, and I think what you're doing, both you and Sabell, is extremely important for all of the American people.
Great to have you, Mel.
Thank you, Sabell.
And I appreciate what you're doing both on the intelligence front and on the media front, because the media needs a good brushback from a guy like you.
Glad to do it.
Melvin A. Goodman, his most recent book, Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Read his recent articles and comments at pubrecord.org and consortiumnews.com. Thank you, Mel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Sabell, Mel Goodman is a fascinating guy, and as I mentioned, I've been talking with him now for 6 or 7 years. And he and Ray McGovern really distinguished themselves as former CIA high-ranking officials who are willing to tell the truth. And if you listen back to our conversation with Mel Goodman, he names names. He doesn't just talk in a broad sense about bad guys at the agency. He is willing to name the names and describe the individuals who he sees as truly responsible for some of the mistakes and the policy errors that we've seen growing in nature and significance over the last 30 years.
Absolutely. And the same thing is true with what he's doing right now with Washington Post. I mean, a lot of people, especially people in his positions, they don't dare going that far. in a way, I'm really proud because he's a member of my organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, along with Ray McGovern.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been always outspoken like this during our congressional campaigns. We have had some briefings in the Senate, in the House, and Mel has been consistent. This is Mel. And no, I agree with you completely.
Yeah. And what's really missing, I think, from a lot of these conversations, and I'm not referring to Mel here, but to discussions about the errors and, you know, serious diversions that occurred under Bush and Cheney, is that, you know, they've got us all feared up. They have the whole focus on defending America and protecting our country and keeping Americans safe.
Yep.
And it has been used more or less successfully to divert people from the oath of office that those same officials took.
Right.
And we heard Bush at one point, I can't date the quote, but he made a comment that, well, you know, I took an oath of office to defend the American people. But that's not what the oath of office says.
Right. They have done a darn good job, and they have been very successful because even us, we are doing it. And this is what I felt during this interview. I just felt that I've had it up to here because it's been always about intelligence and improving the intelligence and defending against the threats and the terrorism and the national security. And it boils down to one word, as you said, the oath of office, the oath of citizenship. It is defending the Constitution. And guess what? There will be no external threat against our Constitution. No country can come and bomb our Constitution. No plane can rip through our Constitution. The only force that can destroy the Constitution of this country, the only threat to the Constitution of our country, is the threat of people within. And these are the people in the office, whether the executive branch or the judiciary branch, or the Congress, the legislative branch, and nobody's talking about that threat. Nobody has been talking about that threat. In fact, we are helping them. We are helping this design by talking about, yeah, true, we are talking about how screwed up our agencies have been, our intel agency, and in what? In doing what? In protecting us against what? The terrorism? I don't know. Well, before it was communism, the Cold War.
Right.
And there will always be the force. And here, our Constitution is being butchered. It's being shredded into pieces. And we don't see the big picture. We are not defending what we are supposed to be defending. We are talking about the intelligence and the terror threat and the czars. And I think we need to do something about that, Peter, because I don't want to play into their hands and do what they want us to do. And that is, we need to put more emphasis on Constitution. As I brought up during the interview, President Obama is extending the three provisions that is about to expire, one of the three worst provisions in the Patriot Act. And as we talked about the state secrets privilege, as we talked about, and we had guests on the whistleblowers protection, and guess what? Nobody's really talking about it because what is it? It's not sexy. It's not hot. It's not scary enough. Well, I don't know what can be scarier than that, because one of these provisions that President Obama wants to extend, wants to put in place again, says they can come after you, they can come after me, and they don't have to have a single reason. They don't have to show a reason. They don't have to have a reason.
Yeah, one of the most odious things that occurred during the Mukasey administration of the Justice Department the last year and a half after Gonzalez was squeezed out was this no-knock warrant that FBI agents essentially are empowered to write their own warrants. They don't have to go to a court. They simply declare, oh yeah, I've got probable cause. And they were given the latitude under this policy that was jammed through toward the end of 2008 to essentially be judge and investigator and issue their own warrants. Oh, and nobody talks about that. There's been no effort to roll it back. And even from the most progressive members of Congress, not a peep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, right now, you just refer to my next piece, which is going to be out this coming Sunday under a series for the makings of the police state. And it is a FBI national security letter. And I was reading some of the provisions there. And it comes with this gag provision, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, they come and they do the stuff with you. Let's say they come to your house, search your house, and come after you. You can't say that on me. You cannot tell to any reporters. You cannot tell your audience, to your listeners, because it comes with this gag provision.
Right.
It comes with a gag provision. You listen to this, Peter. How American does this sound to you? It comes with a gag provision. And the word is there, gag provision. And guess what? Nobody is talking about defending that, defending against that. And as I say, we better start putting the emphasis back again on what is being butchered. And I know this is one of the things you have listed. And I watched this video you had, the YouTube video.
Mm-hmm.
There were about six different alternative media speaking. There were six representatives about the future of the media. So I listened to yours, and this is one of your goals. Well, Peter, this is one of my goals, and this is why we are in this together.
Sibel, I feel the water boiling.
So do I. Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.